police brutality.
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world, and it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we much put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Researchers are studying the sensory impact of the coronavirus, how long it lasts, and what can be done to treat it. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Michael Marshall Ryder. This article is published under the heading COVID's toll on smell and taste. what scientists do and don't know. Here's the details. Early in the COVID-19 pandemic, it emerged that many people infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus were losing their sense of smell, even without displaying other symptoms. Researchers also discovered that infected people could lose their sense of taste and their ability to detect chemically triggered sensations such as spiciness called chemitesis. Almost a year later, some still haven't recovered these senses, and for a proportion of people who have, odors are now warped. Unpleasant scents have taken the place of normally delightful ones. Nature surveys the science behind this potentially long-lasting and debilitating phenomena. How many people with COVID-19 lose their sense of smell? The exact percentage varies between studies, but most suggest that a smell loss is a common symptom. One review published last June compiled data from 8,438 people with COVID-19 and found that 41% had reported experiencing smell loss. In another study published in August 2nd, a team led by researcher Shimati Moin at Institute for Research in Fundamental Sciences in Tehran, Iran, administered a smell identification to 100 people with COVID-19, in which the patients sniffed odors and identified them on a multiple choice basis. 96% of the participants had some olfactory dysfunction, and 18% had total smell loss, otherwise known as anosmia. Usually, these patients say they have lost their smell suddenly, a clue that the symptom is linked to COVID-19, says Moin. And often, the dysfunction is the only COVID-19 symptom that people register, suggesting that the phenomenon is separate from the virus-induced nasal congestion. Some researchers say smell loss should be used as a diagnostic test for COVID-19. A study published last October found that self-reported changes in smell and taste were a better marker of the spread of infection than were other indicators tracked by governments, such as arrivals at hospital, accident, and emergency departments. Why do people with COVID-19 lose their sensitivity to smells? Although the mechanisms are not fully understood, there is an emerging consensus that the smell loss occurs when the coronavirus infects cells that support neurons in the nose. When researchers first identified smell loss as a symptom of COVID-19, they were worried that the virus was infecting the odor-sensing neurons in the nose that send signals to the olfactory bulb in the brain, and that the virus could therefore access the brain. However, the post-mortem studies of people who had COVID-19 have shown that the virus rarely reaches the brain. A team led by Sandeep Robertadatta, a neurobiologist at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts, has instead found cells that support sensory neurons in the nose, known as sustentacular cells, are probably what the virus is infecting. Tata and his colleagues zeroed in on sustentacular because SARS-CoV attacks by targeting a receptor called ACE2 on the surface of cells, and sustentacular cells have many such receptors. Olfactory sensory neurons do not. This suggests that the coronavirus infects the support cells, leaving the neurons vulnerable and deprived of nutrients. But there might be other ways in which COVID-19 induces smell loss. For instance, a research team in Italy showed smell and taste loss occur at the same time as an increase in blood levels of an inflammation signaling molecule called interleukin 6. And a post-mortem study published last December showed clear signs of inflammation, such as leaky blood vessels in the olfactory bulbs of people who had had COVID-19. Although scientists have some understanding of the mechanisms involved in the smell, they have little idea about how the coronavirus affects taste and chemisthesis. Nobody has a good handle on that yet, I know of, says John Hayes, a food scientist at Pennsylvania State University in University Park, who is studying COVID-19 effect on chemical senses. Taste and chemisthesis are senses that are distinct from smell, even though all three combine to tell humans what flavor a food or beverage has. Taste relies mainly on taste receptors on the tongue, whereas chemisthesis relies on ion channels on sensory nerves. Among other mechanisms, and the response to COVID-19 has not been studied much. And how quickly do the impaired senses return? For most people, smell, taste, and chemisthesis recover within weeks. In a study published last July, 72% of people with COVID-19 who had olfactory dysfunction reported that they recovered their sense of smell after a month, as did 84% of people with taste dysfunction. Claire Hopkins, an ear, nose, and throat consultant at Guy's and St. Thomas Hospital in London, and her colleagues similarly observed the speedy return of the senses. They followed 202 patients for a month and found that 49% reported complete recovery over that time, and a further 41% reported an improvement. And how does permanently losing the chemical senses affect a person? Although the condition is not as well studied as the loss of other senses such as vision and hearing, researchers know that the consequences can be severe. One effect is that it leaves people vulnerable to dangers such as food poisoning and fire. For instance, people with anosmia are less able to detect spoiled foods and smoke. A 2014 study found that people with anosmia were more than twice as likely to experience a hazardous event, such as eating spoiled food, as people without a smell loss. Other effects are more difficult to measure. Most people don't acknowledge the importance of a smell in their lives until they lose it, says Moyne. Being unable to appreciate the flavor of food is obviously a major loss, but other sensations are important too. Hayes points, for instance, to the loss a parent would feel if they couldn't connect to their child through the newborn baby smell. And Moyne says that smell dysfunction has been linked with depression, although the biological mechanism involved is unclear. Are treatments available for restoring these senses? A lack of research means few established treatments exist. But one option is a smell training, in which people sniff prescribed odors regularly to learn them. Hopkins is working with a charity called Absent in Andover, UK, to get the word out to the public about this training. There is evidence from before the pandemic. That is, it can improve smell function in some people with such impairments, but it doesn't seem to work for everyone. Available drugs are even more limited, says Hopkins. But for the people in the early stages of COVID-19 infection, when a smell loss might be largely due to inflammation of nose cells, steroids might be helpful, according to a preliminary trial carried out by Hopkins' team. In longer-term research, Richard Costanzo and Daniel Colleo at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond are developing an olfactory implant, a device embedded in the nose that would sense odorant chemicals and send electrical signals to the brain. However, the device is still many years from being offered in clinics, says Colleo. In particular, the researchers need to figure out which areas of the brain the implant should stimulate, he adds, so there is still some science to work out.
The debate.
Republican President Donald Trump left the White House after tumultuous 4 years in office. Democrat Joe Biden has assumed the presidency in a country beset by deep political divides while ravaged by a raging coronavirus pandemic. In this edition of the debate, we will look at what the 46th U.S. president will do that will be different than what Trump has done, and whether that would spell both domestically and abroad. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, Daniel Shaw, is an activist and academic who joins us from New York. We also have Margaret Kimberly, co-founder of Black Agenda Report, joining us from New York. I'd like to welcome you both. Daniel Shaw, let me first start with you. So Trump is out and Biden is in. What has Trump left behind, and how will he be remembered after these four tumultuous years as president?
Well, the ruling class wants to blame everything on Trump, but what we're talking about here is how many centuries of white supremacy, of inequality, of class rule, of nepotism, of everything that U.S. capitalism and imperialism represent. Trump definitely played into that and tapped into that. But though Trump may go away, as he has his private send-off today, trying to take away energy from the 46th inauguration, it's clear that the phenomenon of Trump and systematic segregation in the society and inequality and, of course, U.S. imperialism, U.S. aggression around the world, whether it's Trump in the driver's seat or Biden as the chief CEO of U.S. capitalism, Obama, Bush, Clinton, it's the same system with the same nefarious intentions towards the peoples of the world. So I think many people have a sense of relief right now, but I would caution against that sense of relief because the struggle continues.
Well, talk about struggle. Let me ask you, Margaret Kimberly, when you take a look at the setting of where this took place, 25,000 National Security Guards, you've got thousands of local police and security forces, barbed wires, security checkpoints all over the place in Washington, D.C., in a city that's under a lockdown because of COVID-19, but also because of the violence and protests that perhaps was anticipated. And some have called this worse than the Green Zone in Baghdad, with the combined security forces of Iraq and Afghanistan. In terms of the presence of U.S. forces. Doesn't that give it a different take on the situation, looking at it from that angle?
Well, yes, it does. It's very different from any other inauguration. Inauguration is a big public event, and the public are free to go onto the grounds of the Capitol and watch from a distance. It's a very big event for the nation, and it's quite different to have an inauguration with troops instead of ordinary people. But I as soon as someone talks about the numbers of troops in Washington as opposed to Afghanistan and Iraq, I say to myself, well, that's proof that we can take those troops back home. But yes, 2 weeks ago, there was the riot in the Capitol, and we had a President Trump who, unlike any of his predecessors, did not attend the inauguration of his successor. Even those who are defeated usually have the grace to do that. But Trump was contesting the election up until a couple of weeks ago, so he would not attend. And that gives Biden a lot of, there's a lot of positive feeling for him, but I caution people to remember this is still a president of the United States. He will do what other presidents do, and the fact that you didn't like Trump or you're glad Trump is gone does not mean that you can just let all caution go and engage in wishful thinking about what Biden will do as president.
Well, Daniel Shaw, we're well aware, up to a point, of the deep problems that the U.S. has domestically. You know, we're looking at a divided nation that's been reiterated time and again. You have the racial inequality and injustice that has happened in the U.S., which has reached boiling point. You have an economy that's ravaged by the pandemic, loss of jobs, unemployment, etc. As deep as a problem and challenge that poses the U.S. president, there is problems that he has to deal with outside of the U.S., and we could talk about West Asia. Just initially, looking at the depth of these two huge challenges, how could he tend to both in order to fix the problems? Because you can't take your time fixing one and let the other bleed.
Yes, yes, that's an important point. And as Margaret mentioned, with so much internal discord, similar to 1968 and 1969, when the United States was on the brink of a revolution, as well as France and other capitalist countries, how can Trump's parting shots be to put more sanctions on Venezuela, put Cuba on a terrorist list, try to hike up more aggression against China and Iran, when here at home, Jim Crow segregation continues to reign. Every single day, there's a new record for total amount of COVID deaths. There's an average of 4,300 deaths every day. We've now topped a total of 400,000 deaths. So it's very telling. Dr. Martin Luther King, whose birthday we celebrated yesterday, in his legacy, a legacy that didn't just include nonviolence, but included anti-imperialism, precisely why he was assassinated, because he was able to connect these domestic and international struggles. How can it be that the priorities of this country continue to be to recolonize large swaths of the world that they can't control, where the principal wealth of the world is in South America and in Asia and in Africa? We see AFRICOM, ever-expanding military bases and U.S. military presence. So it would be very delusional to think that now that Trump is gone, that all of these problems of imperialism and looking for domination over the world have suddenly disappeared. So to quote Dr. King, this nation is in sore need of a revolution in terms of its priorities.
Well, Margaret Kimberly, a lot of talk on Biden, but let's focus a little bit about Kamala Harris. Of course, the first woman president for the U.S. Woman power, that's a good thing. We can see the elevation that has taken place in terms of recognition for that position for a woman. Do you think that as this presidency of Biden continues throughout the days and months to come, that a lot of focus will be on Kamala Harris and to see how she can help fix some of the problems that the U.S. is experiencing?
Well, it will be interesting to see how much power she has as vice president. You know, traditionally, that is a position that is does not have very much influence. A lot of people who want to run for president themselves serve as vice presidents. Our Constitution calls for this backup position, if you will, in case the president should be incapacitated or pass away while in office. But vice presidents usually don't have a lot of say. So it'll be interesting to see what Biden will do. Sometimes their vice presidents are the point person for a particular issue. Biden was the point person after the U.S. assisted a coup in Ukraine. So it'll be interesting to see how much power, how much influence she's going to have in the administration. That's open to question. And I despite the historic nature, first female vice president, the fact that she is not white, all of those are things that make for a lot of press attention. But as we've seen with Obama, the fact that she is of African ancestry does not mean necessarily anything good for us. We can expect Biden and Harris to operate pretty much the way other Democratic presidents have operated.
Daniel Shaw, one of the things that was said time and again throughout the inauguration by different speakers, especially in the beginning, was the word democracy. And, of course, they elaborated more on how democracy in the U.S. is broken. How do you think that's going to play on the international arena, where the U.S. is used to dictate to other countries that they're not promoting democracy in their countries when the U.S. itself has a broken democracy?
Yeah, listening to this 46th inauguration speech by Biden and the entire performance there with Jennifer Lopez and the Star Spangled Banner and the Pledge of Allegiance, it's the same rhetoric, it's the same hollow terms. They've used this word democracy every time that they have bombed Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, every time they've waged secret, dirty wars against Argentina and Uruguay and Central America and Syria, and an assault on Iranian self-determination for decades now. So we see right through the word democracy. The question is, whose democracy? When they talk about democracy, they're talking about bourgeois democracy, democracy for the 0.001%. They're not talking about democracy for the 85 million people of Iran or the 30 million people of Venezuela or for the 1.4 billion people of China. What they mean by their democracy is foreign rule and foreign conquest over these massive markets. They're very afraid of any south-to-south unity. That's what China ultimately represents. It represents alternative markets, alternative investment capital for the Bolivarian camp, for the blockaded and sanctioned countries. This great democracy, in quotation marks, that Joe Biden and Trump have talked about so much, has submitted one-fourth of the world's people to cruel, humiliating sanctions and blockades to try to bend their will. So I think we're all deeply indebted to the everyday people of Iran, of Cuba, of Venezuela, of Nicaragua, who continue to pave a different way forward for all of humanity. So whether it's Biden or Trump, they are dead set on U.S. unipolarity. There may be this or that nuance or difference or different tactics with respect to Cuba or Iran, but the end goal is the same, and that's total submission with puppet governments in Tehran, in Havana, in Caracas, in Beijing, which they'll never get because every day the world is more multipolar at this point.
All right, looking inside, Margaret Kimberly, some of the phrases that I picked up from the speech by Joe Biden when he was inaugurated: cry for racial justice will be met. He also said white supremacy, extremism, and domestic terrorism, we will rise to that challenge. These are two huge challenges. Tell us how you think he will tackle them.
Well, I think he'll tackle them in the ways most Democrats do, by appointing certain prominent black people to high office. That's already begun. Saying all the right things about racism in the United States, but not really tackling the foundational aspect of anti-black racism here. And as far as domestic terrorism, I am frankly concerned. You know, 2 weeks ago, all the rioters in the Capitol can be prosecuted under laws we already have. We have to be very careful about this call for domestic terrorism legislation. I'm afraid it will be not be turned against the kind of people who drove into the Capitol on January 6th, but against people like me, against people of color, against the left. That is what happened with the Patriot Act. It actually expanded surveillance against the entire country. The NSA has records of all our electronic communications, all of us, whether we're under any investigation or not. In effect, we all are. So we don't need another Patriot Act. We don't need any anti-terrorism legislation. Everything they did was illegal under current law, and all they have to do is prosecute people who violate those laws. This is a time that we have to think more deeply. And there was a cry for those people to be treated severely, but we have to stop and think about what that means, what it is we really want, and what it is that this system does and whom it attacks.
Listening to him and many other speeches, Daniel Shah, that now the U.S. president has made, Joe Biden, there's not a real sense of urgency behind a concise plan of action that he has for resolving problems. Yet we see that on his first day, he has said that 15 executive actions are going to actually get executed. The Muslim majority travel ban is going to be lifted. He hasn't said all the countries yet. Also, the withdrawal from the Paris Agreement is going to be reversed. The World Health Organization membership, etc. Do you think that he will be a man to just roll back Trump's policies the way Trump did with Obama's, or that he's going to bring something new to the table aside from just reversing some of these Trump policies that Trump enacted?
Yeah, Joe Biden is the opposite of bold. Joe Biden is a 47-year-old, typical spineless Democrat, a Washington insider. He represents the very antithesis of change. He may, of course, overturn, he pledges to overturn 17, to take 17 executive actions to overturn Trump policies in his first day. But that will tinker with the system. These will be small, reformist, incremental things. Not to say that they're not significant. Not to say that ending this travel ban, not to say that increased rights for DACA recipients, all these things are, of course, significant. But at the same time, it would be delusional if we thought for a second that Joe Biden did not represent business as usual. In fact, the ruling class has spoken, and Joe Biden is the person that they chose to steady the ship. All factions of the ruling class united against Bernie Sanders, against the Justice Democrats, against anything that would represent any type of true change. It really brings me back to Malcolm X's quote when he says, "We don't want your crumbs. We want a bakery in which to make our own bread." So Joe Biden is the antithesis of any sense of self-determination for the communities that Margaret has mentioned there, the most oppressed communities. So the movement is going to have to be more vigilant than ever, more mobilized than ever. Let's not forget that under Barack Obama's 8 years, what happened to Libya, the dirty war against the Syrian people, look what happened in Honduras to Zelaya, look what happened in Paraguay to Lugo. Look at the lawfare campaigns, warfare through judicial and legislative means against Dilma Rousseff and Lula in Brazil. So the movement both at home here in the U.S. and internationally has to be on guard to fight against these Dixiecrats, as Malcolm X correctly labeled the Democrats.
Well, Margaret Kimberly, in some of the parting words by the U.S. president before he went to his residence in Florida, he said, quote, "We will be back in some form," promising, obviously, or alluding to the fact that, well, let me ask you, what is he alluding to? If he's addressing his fan base, then he's got a lot on his plate Joe Biden has a lot on his plate when you take a look at what happened with the storming of the Capitol Hill. You got those types of people who are still pro-Trump. If that still persists, the presence of the Trumpism, isn't that just going to prevent Biden from advancing to try to solve this racial divide or this deep divide that the U.S. has?
Well, it depends on Biden's determination. He won. He won not just the Electoral College, but the popular vote as well, a huge turnout. He has a mandate to do what his voters want him to do. This idea that he has to heal a divide, I think is somewhat spurious. He has to govern. And there are things that the people want, that people want him to do. People want Medicare for all. He made some remark about improving access to health care. As you may know, Americans have this health care system that's controlled by the private sector. Millions of people are not cared for. Excuse me. And we need Medicare, the system for the elderly, for everybody, a system that most people like and think serves their needs. So that's the kind of things that he needs to undo. We have this terrible system where young people go into debt to go to college and university. He has to forgive those loans, raise the minimum wage. All he has to do is meet the people's needs. That will heal the divide. You know, one of the reasons I believe that Trump has an appeal with so many people is that those people don't get their needs met either. And I'm not saying they would necessarily change those opinions, but the people who stormed the Capitol would still use Medicare for all if they had it. So we need a system that works in the interest of the people. And this past year, with the COVID pandemic, it's exposed how badly the system works and how little it does serve the needs of the people. We need a bigger stimulus. He claimed there would be a $2,000 payment during the election, and now we're told it's only going to be $1,400, as opposed to other countries which have ongoing support for people during this pandemic period. So I think we need to pay less attention to this talk of him healing and bringing people together. He is supposed to govern, and he is supposed to meet the needs of people who voted for him. That is what we should be looking for.
Okay, I wish we had more time. Unfortunately, we don't, but I'm sure we'll be back with this topic again. Thank you very much, Daniel Shaw, activist and academic. A pleasure. And Margaret Kimberly there, co-founder of the Black Agenda Report. Thank you for your comments from New York. That does it for this edition of The Debate. For Mika Vitafwe, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. The sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made his most definitive break yet with President Donald Trump on Tuesday, 19th of January, while the leader of the incoming Democratic majority laid out an ambitious agenda for the opening weeks of the Biden administration, signaling a dizzying changing of the guard in Washington. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalists Mike DeBonis and Paul Kane. The piece is titled "Uncertainty Reigns in Senate as Schumer Pushes Fast Agenda and McConnell Calls Out Trump." Stay with us for more of Mike DeBonis and Paul Kane's article. outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made his most definitive break yet with President Donald Trump on Tuesday, 19th of January, while the leader of the incoming Democratic majority laid out an ambitious agenda for the opening weeks of the Biden administration, signaling a dizzying changing of the guards in Washington. Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, for the first time directly blamed Donald Trump for the lethal 6th of January assault on the Capitol. The mob was fed lies, he said in his final floor speech, closing out 6 years as majority leader. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. Senator Charles Schumer, a Democrat from New York, outlined a rapid-fire agenda for the coming weeks that includes confirming Joe Biden's cabinet nominees, approving trillions of dollars in additional pandemic aid, and barring Trump from holding office, despite an uncertain roadmap in the 50-50 Senate, which is struggling even to adopt its basic rules. Senator Charles Schumer is set to move from minority leader to majority leader on Wednesday, when the Senate meets shortly after the inauguration of Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, who will tip the chamber towards Democrats with her tie-breaking vote. The next several months will be very, very busy and a very consequential period for the United States Senate, Schumer said on the Senate floor. Let us begin our work in earnest. Significant obstacles threaten each of Schumer's early goals. Republicans have thrown up early roadblocks to some of Joe Biden's key nominees. GOP fiscal concerns could make a bipartisan coronavirus bill difficult to pass, and Trump's impeachment trial threatens to consume the earliest days of the Senate Democratic majority. Beyond that, Schumer and McConnell reached an impasse on Tuesday, 19th of January, in talks to set the open operating rules of the equally divided Senate, making any action a challenge. As Mitch McConnell demanded that Democrats drop any notion of ending the legislative filibuster, McConnell also seized the opportunity to make at least a rhetorical break with Donald Trump at a moment when the consequences are relatively low, with Trump leaving office and the benefits potentially high, possibly winning back donors turned off by Donald Trump's actions. Most of Mitch McConnell's fellow Senate Republicans, however, showed little sign of following suit. Many must still contend with a GOP base that is supportive of Trump, and they could pay a price for denouncing him too forcefully, suggesting the party could face a years-long struggle between those embracing Trump and those distancing themselves. It would take two-thirds of the Senate to convict Donald Trump and bar him from future office. So Republican senators would need to supply 17 votes if all Democrats vote against Trump. Even McConnell did not say whether Trump should be convicted. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, a member of Mitch McConnell's leadership team who just secured a second six-year term, joined a growing group of Republicans arguing that it would be unconstitutional to try Donald Trump after he leaves office, a position that is challenged by some constitutional scholars, but embraced by GOP office holders as they struggle to square Trump's conduct with his popularity among Republican voters. He's not our president after tomorrow, Senator Joni Ernst said, accusing Democrats of wanting to further divide the nation with a Senate trial. We need to start healing. I don't think this does that. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, who has been among a small group of Republicans counseling Donald Trump since the 6th of January riot, said convicting Trump after he leaves the presidency is bad for the presidency and it's bad for the country. But Senator Schumer said Trump's actions, which included repeating baseless claims of a stolen election, calling his supporters to gather in Washington on the day of the electoral vote certification, and then sending them towards the Capitol building as the proceedings got underway, deserved the gravest possible reprimand under America's Constitution. After what he has done, the consequences of which we're all witness to, Donald Trump should not be eligible to run for office ever again, Charles Schumer said. All of us want to put this awful chapter in our nation's history behind us, but healing and unity will only come if there is truth and accountability, not sweeping such a severe charge and such awful actions under the rug. The push for accountability could impinge on the other items on the Democratic to-do list. A presidential impeachment trial has historically been an all-consuming affair for the Senate, impeding virtually all other significant business, and previous trials have lasted several weeks. Donald Trump's first trial in the Senate concluded last February and lasted for 21 days. While some Democratic senators have floated a much shorter trial this time around, the House impeachment managers who act as prosecutors could feel compelled to present witnesses and evidence elucidating the president's role in the violence, as well as legal arguments rebutting the claim that former officials cannot be convicted. The impeachment resolution passed last week in the House of Representatives holds that Trump warrants disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. Language found in the Constitution relating to those who foster insurrection. Senator Richard Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, the number two Democratic leader, said balancing the trial with the other pillars of the Biden agenda would depend on a level of cooperation with Republicans. We need to get President Biden, his team, he said. America is in a terrible situation with this pandemic. We have issues of national security that are still in front of us. We have an economy that's struggling. All of those things are high priorities. Looming over all of the incoming business in the Senate is the unfinished negotiation between Mitch McConnell and Charles Schumer about precisely how a 50-50 Senate will operate. Both leaders are eyeing the rules from the last evenly split Senate in 2001 as a template. Republicans and Democrats agreed then that the party holding the White House, and therefore the vice presidency, would set the floor agenda and chair committees, while the panels themselves would be evenly split. Mitch McConnell, however, threw a new wrinkle into the negotiations, seeking assurances from Schumer that Democrats would swear off any attempt at abolishing the 60-vote threshold for cutting off debate on legislation, something liberal activists have been demanding for years. McConnell's spokesman, Doug Andres, confirmed the filibuster demand remains an unsettled issue. Discussions on all aspects of the power-sharing agreement will continue over the next several days, he said. Charles Schumer's spokesman, Justin Goodman, said the Democratic leader's view is that the fairest, most reasonable, and easiest path forward is to adopt the 2001 bipartisan agreement without extraneous changes from either side. Mitch McConnell and Charles Schumer emerged from a 30-minute meeting reporting no real progress, and some advisers suggested no deal could be struck this week. The impasse, according to multiple Senate aides, could mean that Joe Biden finishes at least his first day in office without any cabinet members being confirmed, a highly unusual circumstance in recent history. Speaking on the floor on Tuesday, 19th of January, Mitch McConnell sent a signal to Democrats by asserting that Joe Biden enters office without a mandate for sweeping ideological change, given the narrow majorities in the House and the Senate, and Biden's platform as a presidential candidate who said he'd represent everyone. Until negotiations over the Senate procedures are resolved, many of Joe Biden's cabinet selections could linger in limbo. Committees will be unable to formally process nominees and send them to the full Senate, and the only path for a nominee would be if all 100 senators agreed to move the selection directly onto the Senate floor. Several Senate committees held hearings on Tuesday, 19th of January, with Biden nominees, including his picks to lead the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, Department of State, and Treasury, as well as his choice for Director of National Intelligence. One roadblock emerged on Tuesday from Republican Senator Josh Hawley, who announced he would object to any effort to advance Alejandro N. Mayorkas, Joe Biden's pick for Homeland Security Secretary, to the Senate floor. In a statement, Josh Hawley cited Biden's immigration platform, which includes creating a path to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants. Mr. Mayorkas has not adequately explained how he will enforce federal laws and secure the southern border, given President-elect Joe Biden's promise to roll back major enforcement and security measures, said Hawley, who came under fire for contesting the Electoral College count even after the mob ransacked the Capitol building. Meanwhile, the incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Robert Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, said Anthony Blinken, Joe Biden's nominee for Secretary of State, would not get a panel vote until next week. And Senate action on Joe Biden's choice for Defense Secretary, retired General Lloyd Austin, is in limbo due to the need for a congressional waiver of the federal law requiring that former military officials must wait at least 7 years before they can become defense secretary. Some Senate aides on Tuesday expressed hope that Janet Yellen, Joe Biden's nominee for Treasury Secretary, and Avril Haines, Biden's nominee for Director of National Intelligence, could win confirmation on Wednesday.